army front, exchanging ground with the Chinese attackers for huge mounds of their dead, Chris continued punishing the smokers in his squad with as much dirty work as he could find, and he could be pretty imaginative. Crispino's military career had started in Italy at the age of 6, when he became and remained until he and his parents wised up and fled to the U.S., a member of Mussolini's Blackshirts. Meanwhile, the kids tried to defend themselves by complaining that in basic training no one had told them that they couldn't smoke in the field. Shit, I thought to myself. What else didn't they learn? Any hope of reserve was lost when orders came down that we were to set up in a delaying position on the east side of the Chorwan Valley and execute delaying actions across yet another mountain range. The Chinese were attacking on a broad front. It was November all over again, only this time it was called the Chinese Spring Offensive, and we were confronting even more Chinamen than we had last time. "Spring is here. Wish we weren't," cracked the jokers. And if there was any comfort in knowing that at least we were not fighting in sub-zero temperatures this time around, the feeling was more than offset by the fact that the warming weather held torments of its own. As the ground thawed out and the spring rains came, the battlefield became a sea of thick, oozing mud. It built up on the bottom of our boots and made them as heavy as lead. Movement was not just putting one boot in front of the next, it was slipping and sliding, and damn hard work. The mud fouled our weapons and equipment. It stuck to our shovels, making the daily foxhole digging ritual a nightmare. Then the rains filled the foxholes, and the futility of it all flooded our hearts. The roads became quagmires. The rivers and the creeks were swollen and hard to ford. The two things that we had going for us over the Chinese were mobility and firepower, but they were advantages greatly reduced in the conditions we now faced. Even so, there was no panic, as there had been in those hard winter days. Ridgway had left his mark on the 8th Army, and mud and rain, big numbers and all, we were set for Joe Chink. We arrived in position at midday. G Company was deployed with two rifle platoons in the valley and my platoon, the third, on a little piece of high ground to their left. The battlefield was quiet, less the occasional rumble of a firefight to our front. But as darkness came, the outpost line, consisting of the 5th Ranger Company, the 25th Recon Company, and B Company 89th Tank, started passing through us with word that the Chinks, millions of them, were right on their asses. This rear guard force had been in heavy contact all day, and they'd had a hard time breaking contact. "They'll be here soon," they warned of the Chinese. "Good luck." Schroeder and I made it a policy that almost to a man, each rifleman in the platoon carried two extra 250-round boxes of 30-caliber machine gun ammo in addition to his basic load. When the men sat down, the ammo sat down. When they walked, the ammo walked. We all hated the extra weight, but it meant the ammo was always there when we needed it for our LMGs, and when things got really bad, we could break it out for our M1s and BARs. Now, in light of the latest word from the outpost line, we had a good look at our ammunition level and then sent our scroungers out for more. And as the rear guard force rolled through, they tossed us stacks of hand flares, grenades, and even more machine gun ammo. So by 1700 hours, the platoon was loaded for bear and well dug in, with good fields of fire for our two light machine guns and our one captured Chinese Bren gun. Schroeder sent a two-man outpost out with instructions not to get engaged, but bug back when they heard the enemy coming. There was a big gap between 3rd Platoon and Fox Company to the west, but a platoon from the 5th Ranger Company was now on the move. They would fill in the gap, making the main battle line complete. We picked out three great positions for the section of tanks we were getting. They'd be able to put flanking fire right down Company G's front and cover in front of G Company 35th Regiment, whom George was tied into on the right. Two Georges in a row, not the best configuration in the world. The tanks would also be able to cover the north-south road that ran smack into George's position and was a good high-speed enemy tank approach. Plus, they'd be able to pummel the hell out of anyone coming directly at 3rd Platoon. We were going to be tougher than the Siegfried line. I heard tank motors and decided to guide them into position myself. "Follow me. You're spending the night with 3rd Platoon of George. Okay, Lieutenant, let's get cracking, shouted the tank commander, competing with the roar of his Sherman. The voice was as familiar as an old coat, and since he'd just promoted me to lieutenant, I decided to hop up and have an eyeball talk with the owner. I should well have recognized the voice. Master Sergeant Francis, Company C, 89th Tank Battalion, had been my platoon sergeant in the recon unit in Italy. He didn't immediately recognize me in the fading light, but he looked the same, tall, craggy, and handsome in a Gary Cooper kind of way. We had a good laugh when he realized he was working for his former gunner private. "It's because I trained you so good, Dave," he said in his soft Kentucky drawl. Hard as we tried, we could not get the tanks up the muddy hill leading to 3rd Platoon's positions. After an hour, Francis decided to pull back and logger for the night behind us. Mud had led to Napoleon's defeat at Waterloo. Now, 136 years later, it had just played a significant role on a small piece of Van Fleet's tumultuous Western Front, and specifically in the fate of George Company. But as I watched the M4s with their mighty 76mm guns disappear down the road, I was not to know that yet. Schroeder told Lieutenant Peterson about the tanks. The CO assigned the company's 57mm recoilless rifle section to replace the armor, and reported that the Ranger platoon would be in position within the hour. With that, I went back to the platoon CP to enjoy the sheer luxury of my new air mattress. I'd just gotten it that morning. Maybe it was Van Fleet's or someone else's way of saying, I'm sorry for cheating us out of reserve. All in all, our supply tail was indeed wagging. A lot of creature comfort goodies were coming our way these days. In general, I liked to think it was a grateful thanks from the stateside war machine, which was running along again at full bore, even if no one seemed to know that by the time a trooper dug a hole big enough to fit his 5'7" by 2' air mattress and then inflated the thing by mouth, he'd probably be too bushed to fight the enemy. At 2015 hours, just as I was beginning to think the rear guard force had either overreacted or had been pulling our legs about all the Chinese, several green flares popped about 500 yards in front of our positions. The outpost was back in a flash, with reports of countless enemy out there. It remained deathly quiet. Peterson was informed of the situation, and we requested max harassment and interdictory H&I defensive artillery fire and flares. Bam, bam, bam! The 8th Field Artillery barked obligingly, and simultaneously our front lit up and shook with the impact of outgoing rounds. Then, under the cold, eerie light of slowly descending parachute flares and the World War II anti-aircraft searchlights we'd asked for, the beams of which, bouncing off the clouds, lit up the battlefield, we saw the enemy. They were marching in column, neat formations as far as the eye could see, each at least a company in strength, marching down the north-south road, one after another. They were not firing. They weren't even in battle formation. It was more like a pass-in-review. Schroeder called in an artillery fire mission with his report to Peterson and told the recoilless rifles, who had a good supply of canister shot, to start blasting. The 8th Field plus all available artillery pounded rounds in front of us and turned the valley into an inferno of high-explosive geysers. F.O. Lieutenant Bell said later he'd had all the American artillery going in the 25th Division's sector, 15 battalions, the second largest barrage of the Korean War, the first being when the division recrossed the Han. Yet all this fire did not seem to put a dent in the Chinese mass attack. The enemy just continued to march like mechanical robots, one foot in front of the other. More Chinese signal flares lit up the cloudy, starless sky. Bugles, whistles, and high-pitched Chinese screams were interspersed with the dull thud of high explosives thumping down in ugly red-black fireballs all along our front, and the steady tap of our machine guns, BARs, and rifles. The Ranger platoon was right behind us now on its way to fill the gap between us and Fox Company, but it got caught. It couldn't get in position between us and the steadily advancing Chinese, who walked right over their dead and, from the high ground, played taps on their bugles to signal objective taken. We shifted a light machine gun to cover the open flank. The Rangers withdrew, and the Chinese kept coming. Where they were going, I didn't know, but wherever it was, they'd been tasked to get there at all costs. 3rd Platoon had 3 Chinese columns marching toward us on separate axes. Ironically, each was headed directly into the field of fire of one of our automatic weapons. We cut their ranks to pieces. Enemy dead were strewn all along the platoon front. Our LMGs were red hot, firing longer and longer bursts of grazing fire from point-blank range. I thought the machine guns would melt before we ran out of ammo, and that, I felt sure, would happen before the columns ran out of chinks. But it was impossible to enforce any fire control as long as they kept coming. But then they stopped. Suddenly, the Chinese broke off their attack on our well-armed position, leaving only their dead to litter our front in scattered mounds of broken, twisted bodies. Like a rich man down to his last million, I guessed even these bastards finally realized that some things cost too much. Not so in the valley below where the main battle raged on. The Chinese left us alone. We were still putting down fire, but we became more like spectators watching a ball game from the 50-yard line. From our high perch, I could see the tracers from our machine guns pouring rounds upon rounds onto the enemy. I could see the Chinese controlling their formations with flares. It was really quite spectacular, in a nightmarish kind of way. In the dark, the artillery recoilless rifles and machine guns firing, the chinks, whistles, and their screaming, the silhouettes of both friend and foe moving through the half-light of flares and searchlights and exploding shells, the huge mounds, 4 to 5 feet high, of enemy dead mounting in front of 2nd and 1st Platoon's positions. I checked the squads. We had 3 U.S. wounded and 1 dead Katusa, Korean Augmentation Troops, U.S. Army. Our light machine gun crew had vanished from the left flank and no one could account for it. We redistributed ammo and reconfigured our defense into a tight perimeter ringing the top of our perch, and then we heard the most incredible sound. As if someone had blown a whistle to stop the game, suddenly there was no shooting in the valley at all. For a split second, there was no firing, no artillery, no flares. Then in their place was a hum, a drone, as the Chinese yelled in terrible, blood-curdling unison and steamrolled their way through our 1st and 2nd platoons, like a great wave crashing over the battlefield. They smashed the position in half, creating a gap of 500 or 600 yards. The floodgate was open, and the enemy was pouring through. From the high ground, we could see them rushing behind us, flattening everything in their path. They washed down the valley, guiding on the north-south road. George's mortars were firing. We could see white sparks as the rounds left the tubes. Then the flood hit them, and the little sparks were submerged. No more mortar section. The 5th Ranger Company, less the platoon originally tasked to fill in the gap on the main line, had set up a blocking position on the valley floor behind George Company. Their plan was to let George pass through them and then meet the Chinese attackers head-on. But George did not come back as an organized force, platoon leapfrogging through platoon. According to Ranger witnesses, the men came back as a panic-stricken mob, and hot on their heels were the chinks. The Rangers could not tell the friendly from the enemy. They held their fire as George Company people ran through their position screaming, "Don't shoot! Don't shoot! George Company!" But the enemy was mixed among George's people, and some got behind the Rangers. It was bedlam. Captain John Scagnelli, the Ranger's fine CO, had no choice but to pull back and try to regain control of his unit, which had unavoidably been split up and intermingled with George guys and Chinese. Through it all, we could hear Master Sergeant Francis's tank's main guns thundering like bass drums from the direction of the battalion CP, and I sent up a silent prayer for a good man. Before long, we were at least a mile behind the penetration. We could hear chink bugles and whistles deep to the south, far beyond where the battalion CP, the Rangers, and other isolated units were somehow hanging on. The Chinese were still all around our little knob, but they ignored us as if we were not there. U.S. artillery was blistering George's vacated positions in the valley, and now we were starting to catch a few rounds of this friendly but no less lethal fire. The Artie had long since cut our sound power line, a a problem at any time, but disastrous now because our SCR-300 radio, which had been acting up all night, was dead. Schroeder, grumbling that the damn thing only seems to work when you don't need it, had me try to call Peterson. George 6, this is George 3-5, over. Nothing. George 6, this is George 3-5, do you read me? Over. Nothing. I was about to give up when I heard my radio break squelch and the faint whisper, George 3-5, this is George 6, Able. I had connected with Peterson's RTO. Let me speak to the 6, I said, referring to the commanding officer. The RTO whispered back in a tearful voice choked with fear. He's gone. I'm lost. There are chinks all around. I'm alone. There was no way I could help him. Keep moving south and keep cool. Destroy your radio. Good luck. Out. By midnight, our area was reasonably quiet. The Chinese were pouring down the road past where our first and second platoons had been dug in. Their medics were picking up the dead and wounded. It was pretty obvious they thought our hill had been taken. We were cut off. I had learned 4 things about being cut off. Keep a cool head, maintain tight discipline and an even tighter perimeter, and don't let the troops panic. Walt Schroeder had won a Silver Star in September in a situation like we were in. Only then the whole battalion had been cut off, and Schroeder had saved George from certain annihilation when he pretty well single-handedly intercepted and destroyed a North Korean force moving directly toward the company perimeter. In the great scheme of things, 3rd Platoon was cool. Over the winter months, we'd all become pros at being cut off. Danny Abella said, call Eddie at battalion. He'll give us the skinny. Eddie Abella, Danny's brother, had been in G Company. Now he was the official 2nd Battalion Operations Sergeant and the unofficial Don of the Hawaiian Mafia. Danny was still a squad leader in our platoon, and on calmer nights, the Abella brothers always checked in with each other. If trouble was brewing, Eddie was on the horn to let us know. If one shot was fired anywhere near the vicinity of the 3rd Platoon of G, Eddie called up to see if Danny and the rest of us were okay. It was great to have a private line into battalion operations and intelligence. There was nothing like being informed. Eddie reported that the Chinese main attack had bypassed the battalion CP and raced southward. He said the CP had been hit by a couple of half-assed probes, but that a ranger officer named Joe Ulatoski had put together a scratch force of cooks, clerks, and George and Ranger Company stragglers who drove off the enemy with the unexpected help of Sergeant Francis's tank section, which had roared into the CP perimeter seemingly out of nowhere. I thought to myself that if we'd had those tanks, none of this would have happened at all. The only guidance Eddie could give me was, hang on, and get the guys out the best way you can. He said that F Company, on the high ground to our left, was quiet and gave me their radio frequencies. Look after Danny, he said, and good luck. Our withdrawal route to the south was a sea of Chinamen. We had to link up with Fox, but after all the trouble that Ranger platoon had run into, we couldn't chance going directly up the ridge to their position. So Schroeder and I talked about it and decided to go north, parallel to the Chinese axis of advance, and then double back along the high ground leading to F Company's front. We had all the guys throw their steel pots away. The Chinese didn't wear helmets, and went down the hill into enemy lines, hoping we looked like Chinese medics toting out wounded. We hadn't gone 50 yards when the radio crackled with the most welcome voice we'd heard all night. It was Captain Michaeli back from R&R. In a whisper, Schroeder explained the mess we were in and the course of action we'd chosen. Michaeli agreed, and on we went. We snaked across the valley floor, dodging medics and stragglers, U.S. artillery, and the Chinese columns still moving south. Once on the ridge directly in front of F Company, we contacted the CO, Lieutenant Norman LaFlame. In the middle of outlining our situation, the SCR-300 radio went dead again, and we spent agonizing minutes reestablishing commo. Finally, Schroeder was able to get through, this time on F Company's internal net. This is George 3, he whispered. George 3, this is Fox 1, came the reply. I recognized the voice. It belonged to one Lieutenant Barney K. Neal. Oh, shit, I thought. He and I had met before, and it hadn't been pleasant. About a month earlier, I'd been sitting with some of the guys by a fire on a very cold day when this bundled-up figure walked up and asked for directions to the G Company CP. "Just keep walking, buddy," I told him. "Straight ahead. You'll find it." "Do you realize you're addressing a lieutenant in the United States Army?" he boomed, followed quickly by, "Why aren't you standing at attention, soldier?" Then I'd seen the brass bar of this young, parade-ground-perfect second lieutenant. My guys just watched, waiting to see how I'd handle it. No way was I going to stand up. I said, "Look, Lieutenant, I'm doing the same damn thing you're doing in this war without bars, so don't pull that rank bullshit on me, okay?" It wasn't exactly true. Schroeder was the platoon leader in our outfit, not me, but I didn't care. The guy made me mad. And anyway, officer platoon leaders came and went so fast that unless they were really something, they didn't even make a dent in a unit in the first place. Only the NCOs did that. Neil tried to get bad, but my guys and I went back to staring at our fire. Finally, he melted behind his little bar and disappeared with, "We'll see what your company commander thinks of this, Sergeant." His Oklahoma accent had been indelibly etched in my brain. Now, as Schroeder continued to talk to him, I kind of wondered whether I'd be better off staying out in the dark with the Chinese. Schroeder asked him to throw two illuminating hand flares in succession. We couldn't be sure with just one, which could just as easily be a spooked trooper popping a flare, so we could get a fix on his position with the compass. When we started to move, our big worry was no longer the Chinese. It was that we'd get ironed out by our own artillery, which was still blistering through the valley, or a friendly but nervous trigger finger. There are few more dangerous movements than entering a friendly front line when a fight is going on, but Neil assured us that Fox Company's H&I was shut off, and the whole unit knew we were on our way. "Fox Company, this is George," Schroeder yelled, taking no chances when we were a couple hundred yards out. "We're coming in." "Hold up," Neil called. "I'm sending a guide. Got booby traps and flares out there." We were received with open arms. We split the guys up, one in each of First Platoon's holes. The lieutenant didn't recognize me, but he was so friendly that I decided to confess I was the insubordinate sergeant he'd met that cold morning in March. It turned out Neil was not at all the garrison soldier Martinet I thought he was. He'd just been reacting to our generally surly fireside attitude. So we sat up the rest of the night bullshitting, and Barney K. Neil and I began a friendship that would last for the rest of his life, until he was killed as a battalion commander in another war 19 years later. At first light, 3rd Battalion's K. King Company arrived. Theirs was not a happy lot. The whole 3rd Bat had been on the move as the Regimental Fire Brigade for more than a week already, and they were flat worn out. Most recently, after George and the Rangers got brushed aside, the 3rd Bat had taken the Chinese attackers head-on in their blocking position deep in the valley behind our battalion CP and stopped them cold. Then K Company was attached to 2nd Bat and sent on a 16-mile hike in the dark back over the rugged terrain the enemy had steamrolled through, with the mission of sliding behind F Company and then fighting through and sealing the initial penetration by occupying G Company's holes. It was all standard procedure, but to the guys in King, there had to be an easier way to fight a war. So K slid down through F just before first light. The company commander was not in a good mood. He didn't want to go down in the valley. It was very bad down there. A lot of Chinese, a lot of artillery, both Chink and American, blasting the hell out of everything on the valley floor. He asked Barney K for a sit rep. Barney said, "Talk to Hackworth. He's from G Company." I thought, no, don't let him know I'm from G Company. Don't tell him. Too late. King's CO said to me, "You'll lead the way." "Like hell we will. We've got the job of closing the hole. It's not our job." "Yeah, but you're the bastards who bugged out." "We didn't bug out. We were overrun, and no way are we going to be your point into that valley. No fucking way." I quickly added, "Lieutenant," realizing that this little bantam was bone-tired, pissed off, and would not take much more from me. He looked as if he was just angry enough to blow me away. Still, I felt guilty. My company had caused this mess. Maybe we did bug. Maybe we were just a bunch of yellow-bellied bastards, as the King Company lieutenant went on to say. And now, with his bad-mouthing my unit, it became a point of honor. I told him we'd go down with him. You take the 2nd and 1st platoon's holes, 3rd platoon will occupy its own. Down we went. King successfully sealed the penetration, and the Chinese were caught in a net. As the dawn was breaking from our old positions, I could see the complete battlefield. The Chinese were like chickens in a slaughterhouse yard, running in circles with their heads cut off, while P-51s darted down from overcast skies, bombing and strafing anything that moved, and artillery kept pounding in. The Rangers have been given the mission of sweeping and clearing the valley, the CO of King informed us. Your platoon is attached to them. I'm squatting in G Company's holes. Good luck. In that at least two-thirds of George had been scattered to the winds, and for all practical purposes we were no longer an effective combat force, it was logical to follow King's CO's orders. We joined what was left of the Rangers under Captain Scagnelli's command. John Scagnelli was a soldier's soldier. In his World War II paratrooper's uniform, he looked the quintessential devil in baggy pants. Tough, squat, with the smashed face of a boxer, he was one bad, pugnacious hombre. American parachutists, devils in baggy pants, are less than 100 meters from my outpost line. I can't sleep at night. They pop up from nowhere, and we never know when or how they strike next. Seems like the black-hearted devils are everywhere. Extract from the diary of a German officer who opposed the 504th Parachute Infantry of the 82nd Airborne Division on the Anzio beachhead in 1943. His 5th Airborne Rangers were among the finest fighting men in the U.S. Army, strictly professional. "You'll sweep the right of the valley, tie in online with my 1st platoon," snapped the Skag. I was proud to be part of his operation. Its precision reminded me of the old 351st in Trieste. We formed a skirmish line, soldiers lined up abreast, 10 yards apart, that stretched across the valley floor, a moving wall of weapons on the hunt for human beings. Soon we came across the body of a Ranger lieutenant. It was a gruesome sight. Fred Lang was a huge guy, an ex-Oklahoma A&M football star who, I later found out, was a classmate of Barney K. Neal's. The lieutenant had been hit in the legs early on. And the story, as I gathered from the Ranger's shorthand discussions over his body, was that Lang, who was far too heavy to carry, had told his men to prop him up by a trail with a bunch of ammo and grenades and get the hell out of there. Lang had done a Custer's last stand, blowing away Chinamen until they blew away him. But apparently that wasn't enough for the Chinks. Then they'd gotten him with their bayonets. The Chinese bayonet on the Soviet SKS rifle was only about 8 inches long. It was not so much a bayonet as a large and lethal three-pronged leather punch. It didn't make a clean cut. It made more like a rip, and the dead Ranger officer was just ripped to pieces. With jagged punctures all over his body, he was just a mound of shredded body flesh. It seemed to us that every Chinese trooper had administered his own coup de grace as he filed past the lieutenant's body. This pissed the Rangers off. It got to all of us. The word went out, no prisoners. The Rangers were like NYPD cops when one of their own was shot down. Vengeance, swift and without mercy. What followed that day, walking through the valley, was not a sweep, but a bloodbath. Chinks were coming at us, and we just mowed them down. Many played possum, lying motionless on the ground, pretending they were dead. When this was discovered, every single corpse got a slug in the head. If blood pumped out, you knew you'd gotten a live one. It'd be fair to say that we were all a little in shock by the time the mop-up was over. Regiment would later estimate that 722 casualties were inflicted on the enemy that morning. But all we knew at the time was the valley floor was blood red and littered with dead Chinese. And then there was nothing more to do. We headed south, the platoon passing through the 3rd bat positions where they'd stopped the Chinks the night before. "Hey boys, here comes G Company, the cowards," someone shouted. "Yeah, G for guys who bugged. You rotten sons of bitches." We all hung our heads and walked as fast as we could, trying to ignore the jeers. Bug out was an officially forbidden phrase in the Wolfhounds. Its use, even in a whisper, tended to cause panic on the battlefield. Now that the whole thing was over, though, It was open season on old George, and it was humiliating. We were a proud company, not the kind that bugged. Still, 3rd Platoon had had a machine gun team disappear in the middle of the battle, and no one had seen it since. In the heat of a firefight, a platoon leader can't be everywhere. Neither can a platoon sergeant. Somehow, as the battle warmed up, neither Schroeder nor I got over to the left flank light machine gun, and by the time I did, it was gone. Jerry Boyd and friends vanished. Maybe they'd bugged. Maybe they'd been killed. Maybe it was our fault. We walked down the muddy road, passing by the gun positions of the 8th Field. And who should be there with them but Jerry Boyd? A totally intact Jerry Boyd with the rest of the guys from our missing gun crew, sitting around with the 8th Field as if they belonged there. We kept walking. Jerry came running up. "How you doing, boss?" He wasn't wearing a steel pot, just his pile cap, earmuffs askew. He looked like Pluto the dog. I wouldn't look at him. "What are you doing over there with the 8th Field?" He said, strutting along now with his jive accent, "I'm a motherfucking gunner now, man. Automatic artillery. Bam, 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 that's me." Looking straight ahead, I said, "Jerry Boyd, what happened last night?" "You told us to move out, so I moved out." "I'm not going to be staying around when somebody's saying to move out and the Chinese are coming at me like some roller skating snowmen." "I never said move out. I don't want to talk to you, Jerry Boyd. I don't want to know you. You've lost me for life." Now, this was to Jerry, my brother, my foxhole buddy, the guy I shared my toothbrush and all my secrets with. Jerry kept swearing that he was telling the truth. Then more of the missing guys came up, and they said it happened too. Finally, we were able to piece the story together. When the Ranger platoon, which happened to be the Ranger's 3rd platoon, got hit going into position between us and Fox Company, a Ranger had yelled to his people, "3rd platoon, let's go," and Jerry Boyd and crew had automatically saddled up and gone with them. And there I'd been, worrying because 2 George companies were tied in together on the other side. Then, when the Rangers got into more trouble down on the valley floor, my guys split for safer ground and walked until they found the 8th Field. "So I'm not the bad guy you thought I was," said Jerry. "I know what your mind was thinking. You were thinking when those Chinamen yelled Banzai, old Jerry said goodbye. Now you got the truth. Think I should get a medal, Hack, for saving my boys." "Let me tell you something, Jerry Boyd. I've got your medal. Hanging. The last time I saw you, you were holding a machine gun. My machine gun. You do not have a machine gun right now, and I don't want to see your face until I see you holding a machine gun again, just like the one you had on that hill. Until I see you with an M19A6 Browning machine gun, caliber 30, brand new, I don't know you. Got it?" "Sure thing, boss," Jerry said, and he bopped away, shining his giant smile to find a new MG. We kept heading south, leapfrogging through other units. At 1600, when the column halted and the battalion dug in, George Company was tasked as battalion reserve and reorganized behind the new front in an abandoned village. In a cluster of Korean mud-walled huts, we found many tired familiar faces, G Company brothers from the other platoons who'd straggled in a few at a time, and huge mounds of new gear. The company had almost nothing except its rifles and what we had on our backs. Everything else had been abandoned in the battle. Our asses in exchange for our equipment. Not much of a deal, I thought, even as we took what we wanted from big piles of brand new cartridge belts, weapons, steel pots, sleeping bags, pile jackets, and anything else we could need. Everyone was still bad-mouthing us. No one had a good word for George. "Watch out, there's Bug Out George." When they said push on, George heard Pusan, and they've been heading south ever since. But G Company had not run. As we gathered our unit together and started swapping stories around our ubiquitous campfires, it became clear that 1st and 2nd platoons couldn't have fought more valiantly. The Chinese had just poured through. Regiment reported that 2 reinforced battalions had blasted through the positions. To those on the ground, 2 reinforced regiments, perhaps even a division, was closer to a true figure. One little Hawaiian guy, who was a machine gunner in the 2nd platoon, told me he'd been firing long bursts of machine gun fire, 20 or 30 slugs a hit, into the advancing Chinese ranks. The Chinks didn't even try to knock out the gun. They just kept coming, until in the end, the machine gun got so hot it wouldn't fire. The Hawaiian whipped out his .45 caliber pistol and started blasting away with that. 8 dead Chinks later, he found himself sharing his hole with an empty pistol and a live Chinaman. He beat that guy to death with the butt of the pistol, and it was only then that he decided he'd better get his ass out of there. There really wasn't anything more he or any of the guys in those two platoons could have done. The Chinese had literally steamrolled right through. Meanwhile, Lieutenant Peterson, who showed up in the village to a few choice words from Schroeder, said he'd withdrawn the company under pressure and swore he'd tried to get the word to 3rd Platoon that the rest of the unit was hightailing the scene. When he couldn't raise us on the radio, he said he'd sent up a runner. It was pretty damn apparent the kid never got there, and we went on blaming Peterson even though Lieutenant Bell took full responsibility for the decision to withdraw in the first place and for leaving 3rd Platoon behind. From his FO perch on the northeastern slope of our little hill, he'd watched the whole battle, knew the company could never survive the massive onslaught, and felt the rest of the unit would be zeroed out if they stayed until we got the word. Bell's decision had been the right one, but it was not easy to convince any of us in 3rd Platoon. The bottom line, though, was that the whole thing had happened without the Rock at the helm. Had Captain Michaeley been there from the beginning, maybe we as a company could have held. I know damn well we would have executed an orderly withdrawal. Continuity of command is extraordinarily important on the battlefield. On a night like 26-27 April 1951, it was essential, and it wasn't there. Besides, Lieutenant Peterson just wasn't cut out to be a company commander. He was too nervous, and we felt his every quiver. His heart was in the right place, and he wasn't lacking individual guts. The story went that he'd been an NCO with the Reserve Commission working in a finance office in Japan. He'd felt guilty he wasn't in Korea and put in for active duty so he could go over. In his first fight in November, he'd gone out with the platoon as an observer, and when the platoon leader was hit, he'd taken over as platoon leader. When the rest of the platoon leaders and the company commander were hit, he'd found himself as the company commander. Then he'd gotten hit and was evacuated back to Japan. A Silver Star winner, he'd come back from the hospital and joined G Company as executive officer in a way that reminded me of my first encounter with Barney K. Neal. Schroeder told me that just before the Han River crossing, I was still in the hospital, he'd picked out a great hut for the NCOs, only to have Peterson come by and make all the sergeants move out. The hut was for the officers, he'd said. Later that day, some booze found its way into the company through an R&R returnee, and Schroeder and another sergeant named Baxter got so drunk they decided to burn the hut down. Captain Michaeley raked both men over the still red-hot coals for that one, but all the NCOs thought it was the best laugh south of the Yalu. The reason Peterson was given command of George was simply that he was the ranking lieutenant at the time Michaeley went on R&R. When the captain returned the night the Chinese broke through, having danced at the Osaka Officers Club with Spotlight Sim's wife, all the while having to pretend that Sims was alive and well because the wife hadn't received news of his death on Jake Abel through official channels, he'd immediately been assigned as battalion operations officer. That's why we heard him on the battalion net during the fight, and also why we'd end up having to go it alone. Things were so screwed up in the battalion chain of command that Michaeley had ended up running the whole second bat show. Without him, the whole unit, not just George Company, might well have been destroyed. Our brilliant commander, Colonel Murch, had left 2nd Battalion in early March. From the first, this departure created some upheaval. Neither his first replacement, who was relieved of command early in his tenure, nor the new CO, whom I'll call Colonel Cork, could come anywhere close to Murch's brand of leadership or tactical skill. Most of the battalion leaders felt that Murch's ability and example were responsible for the uniformly fine performance of the 2nd Bat from the outset of Wolfhound involvement in the war. That we'd continued on in fine form since was a credit to the foundation he laid during his 8 turbulent months of command. When all was said and done, unquestionably, the battle had been a hell of a mess from beginning to end. But when all the stories were told, we knew George had done the best it could, and as a company, we started holding our heads up again. The guys continued straggling in, and after a good night's sleep and a packet of new replacements to fill our ranks, we headed south again as part of the regiment's rear guard action. As April drew to a close, the Wolfhound's official S3 summary for the month reported the result of the Chinese spring offensive, and this period of the most intense fighting I would ever experience. Offensively, the 27th Regimental Combat Team, RCT, advanced for a period of 45 days from the Han River. Defensively, the RCT withdrew approximately the same distance in 6 days. On our way back, we passed an element of the 25th Recon Company set up in a delaying position along the side of the road. They were from my old platoon, the one I'd gone AWOL from 100 years before. There were a number of guys from my scout section there as well. And when we saw one another, it was like a family reunion. The guys walked along with our column for a while, and soon my old platoon sergeant, whom I'd always gotten along well with, heard I was there and joined us. He told me that the platoon leader lieutenant who'd provoked my going AWOL had been killed. He'd fought bravely, died heroically, and won the DSC in the process. I was truly sorry to hear he'd been killed, but glad to know he'd shaped up and become a proper leader before he cashed in his chips. "What about you, Hackworth? I hear you're quite a hero yourself," the sergeant said. "And you keep coming back for more?" He shook his head. "You're a glutton for punishment, young sergeant." I laughed and told him that maybe I was, but then he continued, "You know what I think, Hackworth? I think somewhere along the line you got stuck by the glory bayonet." The glory bayonet. I'd never heard that expression before. At first I thought the sergeant was just using it to describe my gung-ho attitude to soldiering. But after we'd parted company and I continued walking down the road, I couldn't help stop thinking about what he had said. What made me a fighter, a warrior, was a combination of trust, training, and family tradition. My grandmother had told me from as early as I could remember the glorious battle record of the Hackworths from the moment they landed in the Virginia colony in the early 1600s. Two had been high-ranking officers at the Battle of Point Pleasant in 1774, she said, and one, Augustine, had been Andrew Jackson's deputy in the War of Independence in 1776. It wouldn't be for many years that I discovered my high-ranking ancestors had actually been privates and realized that Andrew Jackson was 9 years old when the colonies revolted against the Brits, but it didn't matter. Graham's faulty memory helped give shape to a feeling that maybe I was born with. I was going to be a soldier. Graham didn't get it completely wrong. My great-great-great-grandfather, John Hackworth, and his four brothers did all fight in the Revolutionary War. John Hackworth's father, George, was given land by King George for fighting Frenchmen and Indians in the mid-1750s. My great-great-grandfather, also named John, was a captain in the 56th Kentucky Regiment in the early 1800s, and his son Jeremiah, wearing blue, fought his cousins in gray during the Civil War. The strong soldiering tradition continued right up to World War II when my brother, and then I too, took up the call. Graham's brother, Uncle Roy, had served as a buck sergeant in World War I. He'd won a Silver Star. "That and a nickel will get you a cup of coffee, boy," he'd say whenever I asked if I could see it, and lived in Arizona in an old soldier's home due to mustard gas wounds he suffered in the trenches. He died when I was 9, but I'd never forget sitting with him behind Jerry's liquor store in Ocean Park whenever he came to visit, listening to the bleak and glorious war stories I'd beg him to tell, which he'd always punctuate with the slug from the bottle of cheap wine he carried in a brown paper bag. One time I'd gone racing into the newly installed indoor john of our house, not knowing he was in there taking a bath. I'd never seen Uncle Roy in anything but his clothes, and what I saw in the bathtub was a body that was kind of half a body. It was as if there were no muscles in one of his shoulders, just a discolored mustard gas burned bone that stuck straight out. An exposed ligament seemed to be the only thing preventing his arm from falling right off. It was without a doubt the most horrific thing I'd ever seen. But as horrific as it was for me at the age of 6, it was equally compelling. The horror of the battlefield and the quiet dignity of a soldier all rolled into one, and the image would stick with me for life. So Graham and Uncle Roy did their bit, And the movies, too. The Dawn Patrol, The Fighting 69th, Sergeant York, All Quiet on the Western Front, were my inspirations. And after 7 December 1941, I'd gone to sleep every night not counting sheep, but instead shooting imaginary Japs out of imaginary trees with an imaginary gun, inflicting imaginary but very heavy and extremely justified damage on a very real enemy who had committed the outrage of Pearl Harbor. All the groundwork for my future had been laid, long before Trust, long before I had a war of my own here in Korea. Given that, how could I have been stuck with the glory bayonet? The enemy now, the North Koreans and the Chinese, had not committed the same offense as the Japanese in World War II, but I'd learned that they represented something even more sinister. The communists, who were hell-bent on taking over the world. They had to be destroyed, and that was my job. The one glory in that was the feeling of being part of the force that was going to protect all the free world held near and dear. The more Reds you killed, I guess, the more well thought of you were. Maybe that was what the recon sergeant was talking about. But there was certainly nothing glorious about being tired and dirty all the time and watching your friends get blown away. And yet, right there lay the key to why I was so gung-ho and why I'd never quit. Sure, I was fighting for America, for all that was right and true, for the flag, the national anthem, and Mom's apple pie, but all that came second to the fact that the reason I fought was for my friends, my platoon, and as I walked on, I concluded that that was why most other soldiers fought too. The incredible bonding that occurred through shared danger, the implicit trust in the phrase, cover me. These were the things that kept me going, kept me fighting here in Korea, and why I'd come back for more, for as long as my bottle held out. And though I did like the glory inherent in my steadily growing reputation as a good warrior, the most important thing was that I knew with other troopers' respect came their trust. They knew that I wouldn't let them down, and to the best of my ability, I never would. So much for the glory bayonet, I thought, and picked up the pace to catch up with my platoon. 5. By the direction of the President. Hack lived every day as if he were on top of a big, big wave. He was very excited about his military career and wanted to prove his worth as a leader. The only problem he ever caused me, and it wasn't really a problem, was that any time I issued an operation order, Hack always wanted his platoon to lead the attack. Some discretion had to be given to the fact that he was not only volunteering his own life and safety, but the lives and safety of 42 other soldiers in his command. But Hack's demonstrated example rubbed off on the members of his platoon. Soon they all wanted to fight and be like him. It was a delightful experience having such an effective fighting machine. Lieutenant Colonel Del Evans, United States Army, retired. Company Commander, Echo Company, 27th Infantry, Korea, 1951. Van Fleet's Line Lincoln, 5 miles north of Seoul, was where the Chinese offensive finally ran out of punch. It was a defensive position right out of World War I, with deep trenches, bunkers, and heavy field fortifications protected by minefields and barbed wire. The Chinese attackers, whose logistics tail was well overextended, couldn't make a dent in it. With the enemy on their knees, the hard-fighting 8th Army was preparing yet another offensive, but as of 3 May 1951, the only American defense to be let down was mine. "They want your ass down at division, Hack," First Sergeant Flemings remarked as he walked into the 3rd Platoon CP. "Looks like you're going to be commissioned whether you like it or not." "Top, you know I don't want to be a lieutenant," I replied. "Tell that to the boys at division." It was not a new conversation. In fact, it was one I had had as far back as Trust with Captain Eggleston when he'd recommended me for officer candidate school. Luckily, or unluckily, depending on how you looked at the war, Korea had broken out before my OCS orders came through, and I'd been spared the ordeal. With Sergeant Flemings here in George, we'd been going over the same turf for the last 2 months. The only difference was that our discussion, which had been more or less hypothetical, was now a full-blown reality. Soon after I'd returned from the hospital in March, Phil Gilchrist had recommended me for a battlefield commission. He had taken the case to Captain Michaeley, who approved the promotion, then on to Colonel Cork, who only recently had taken command of the 2nd Battalion. The criterion for a battlefield commission was simply to be a proven combat leader. Education, family connections, even officer potential played little part. It was an honor won only on the battlefield. Its recipients, the spirited frontline fighters who got the job done and could inspire their fellow troopers to do the same. As a board of officers reported to the commanding general of the European Theater at the end of World War II, on the battlefield, if a platoon sergeant whose platoon commander has been killed can successfully lead 50 scared, confused men who depend on him for everything and who must be made to accomplish what they think is impossible, it is of no consequence if the AGCT, Army General Classification Test score of that man is less than 100 and he never attended high school. From A Brief History of Battlefield Commissions in the Armed Forces, the National Order of Battlefield Commissions. In 10 months of Korean combat, only 8 men in the 27th Infantry Regiment had been commissioned in the field. Most of them were dead. The price paid for being a Mustang, as the Marine Corps called their battlefield commissions, for never being reluctant to stand up and charge when the chips were down, was often one's own life. In truth, I felt honored to be considered worthy of inclusion among this distinguished group of warriors, but there was one problem. I didn't want to be an officer. Being an officer didn't jibe with my childhood expectations of army life or the reality of my 7th grade education. In trust, I'd had so little self-confidence that the only thing I was sure of in terms of my ability to handle OCS was that I'd flunk out the first day. Now, having been a non-com for more than 2 years, I'd concluded that I was an NCO through and through, and there seemed little reason for jumping into the officer ranks. "I don't want to be like all those 90-day wonders, Sergeant Flemings," I pleaded with the top kick, referring to OCS graduates. "They don't show me anything. I want to be a platoon sergeant like I am now and just run my platoon. Then one day maybe a master sergeant. I'll be happy as shit when I've got 3 stripes up and 3 stripes down. I don't want to be a lieutenant." Flemings nodded. "And what if you don't make master sergeant? Look, Hack, if you don't take the commission, one day some second lieutenant, might come in and take over your platoon. He also might get a lot of your people killed. Then how would you feel? You've got to take the promotion and look after your troops." The first sergeant had a point. And besides, he'd been there and done it all while I'd just been dreaming about it. He was a from-here-to-eternity NCO, and straight as a die. Flemings knew the score, and I knew he was right. This time, when it counted, he'd worn me down. "Okay, Top," I said. "You got a deal. If I can keep my platoon." The paperwork was done at Division Rear, 150 miles to the south, near Taegu. The Adjutant General, Lieutenant Colonel Master, put me in a tent where casuals slept. I stretched my fart sack out on the dirt floor and marveled at the luxury of my plush quarters. Electric lights, no less. I went to be processed, which meant closing out my old records and opening up new officers' ones, and the next day, by the direction of the President, the AG swore me in. He pinned a second lieutenant's bars on my right lapel and then asked me where my crossed rifle infantry insignia was. I didn't have one. As it turned out, neither did he. So he pinned another brass bar on my left lapel, which is how they're worn in the U.S. Navy, and said, "Well, that's it, Lieutenant. Congratulations. Report to Division Forward soonest." "How do I get there?" I asked him. "You figure it out, Lieutenant." I hadn't told the guys I was sharing the tent with that I was there to be commissioned, so when I went back to collect my trusty M1 and my gear, they all thought it was quite amusing that I was now an officer and a naval officer at that. I was pretty embarrassed by the whole thing, especially because I didn't feel any different at all. I'd sort of thought something would happen. I didn't know what, but something, and nothing did. I was still Sergeant Hackworth with 2 bars. 2, to be exact. I went to the road and put out my thumb. A truck picked me up, and for the first time in my life, someone called me sir. The driver said, "Where are you going, sir?" I told him north, and that I'd been a sergeant up until a few minutes ago, so don't call me sir. "Yes, sir," he replied, and we roared down the road. At Division Forward, I met another wolfhound who'd just been commissioned, Lieutenant Ushida from C Company 1st Bat. Ushida was an old guy of at least 27, who'd served with the famed 442nd Regimental Combat Team in World War II, fighting his way through Italy, Normandy, and across Europe. I'd always admired the 442nd. It was just a great fighting team, and with 314% casualties, had won more Purple Hearts than any other regiment, as well as more than 18,000 individual awards and 7 Distinguished Unit Citations. So I guess it was only natural that I admired Ushida, too. We spent the day together. I pumped him for war stories and in the course of it all really became close to him. That night, after the division briefing, there was a little ceremony. Ushida and I stood up, and Brigadier General J. Sladen Bradley, who'd recently taken over the 25th Division from General William Keane, pinned on our bars. Bradley was a fine fighting general himself, and now he gave us a quiet speech, making no bones about his belief that we, as battlefield commissions, as Mustangs, were among a rare breed of fighting men. With that, I said goodbye to Lieutenant Ushida, with the hope that someday we'd tie in on the line or something. But it was not to be, and when I heard he was killed in combat soon after we were commissioned, a fate this good man shared with the majority of the 27th Battlefield Commissions, most of whom did not survive the war, it knocked me for one very serious loop. I reported into 2nd Battalion HQ for what was to be my first eyeball-to-eyeball with our new battalion commander, Lieutenant Colonel Cork. I'd heard little about him in the month or so he'd been with the unit. From the scuttlebutt, it seemed that 2nd Bat would have gone to hell in a high-speed handbasket had it not been for our S3 Battalion Operations Officer, Captain Michaeli, who more or less ran the battalion, not just in late April during the Chinese Spring Offensive, but every day of the week. Staff officer positions are numerically designated. 1, personnel. 2, intelligence. 3, operations. 4, logistics. The command level on which the staff officer works is designated alphabetically. The prefix S refers to special staff on the battalion, regiment, or brigade levels. G refers to general staff on the division, corps, or army levels. And J refers to joint staff, combined services of Army, Navy, and Air Force. On first impression, Cork was not my kind of soldier. He was drunk, or well on his way, when I reported in at midday. He slurred out that I was going to Easy Company. I protested, telling him I was from George, and that the first sergeant had said I'd return to my unit. "Well, George Company's first sergeant doesn't run this battalion, does he?" Cork asked. "The first sergeant is far more capable of running this battalion than you'll ever be, you drunk, silly-looking son of a bitch," I thought to myself, but kept my mouth shut. "You're assigned to Easy Company. Dismissed," mumbled Cork, and then something more about not getting myself killed. It was the middle of the night by the time I found Easy Company's trains. There I met First Sergeant Cox, a good man who'd been with the Wolfhounds as far back as Japan. He was a real pro, a fine soldier who helped me one hell of a lot until I got the hang of this platoon leader business. I was a little afraid of it, despite the fact that I'd been doing the job in one way or another, on and off since Italy. Now Cox said the battalion was online, E Company was up forward, and since I was eager to get cracking, why didn't I take up the resupply trains? It was a reasonable suggestion, and off we went into the pitch-black night. No one really knew where we were going, least of all me. We didn't know exactly where the front was, and before long we didn't even know where we were. Shit, I thought. If Cox had known what a rotten ground navigator I was, he'd never have given me this job. But he had, and on we went. Me, a few troopers, and 15 Korean laborers loaded down with more than twice their weight in ammo, water, and other supplies. The Korean laborers were the third tier of Korean nationals involved in the war under the auspices of the 8th Army, the Republic of Korea, ROK ROC Army, and the Korean Augmentation Troops U.S. Army, KATUSAs, were the other two. The ROCs had disintegrated in the first moments of battle, almost 11 months ago when the North Koreans invaded the South. Since then, they'd reformed, gotten into fighting shape, and now fought side by side with units of the United Nations forces. The KATUSAs' origins were the beginnings of the war itself, when Syngman Rhee, president of South Korea, declared a state of emergency and initiated a draft. About 100,000 young men were rounded up, both to train and to be kept out of North Korean hands. When the time came to farm them out to ROC units, it became apparent that a huge surplus of replacement troops existed. Someone then had the idea to integrate these soldiers into the U.S. units, which had arrived in country with only 2 understrength battalions per regiment, and before long the augmentation occurred. Unfortunately, most of these Catooses were not worth shit as fighters. For them, bugging out was the rule, not the exception. But it really wasn't their fault. They had no understanding of the English language, and U.S. infantry guys on the ground knew no Korean. As Captain Michaeli explained the Catoosa problem best, how could they have full faith in somebody they couldn't even talk to? Still, the Catoosas came and stayed until they bugged or were wounded or killed. They generally worked in pairs, with the survivors normally ending up as ammo bearers for the units. Communication was just one of the problems between Korea and U.S. troops. Ethnic customs and religious beliefs were often miles apart in the two cultures, and little or no effort was made to bridge the gap. One crisis that occurred among the laborers in our battalion began when, for morale purposes, it was decided Lion White, the code name for 2nd Battalion 27th, needed a new battalion sign.